So let's see whether that's better. Yes, let's hope so. So the people who aren't here don't get the Happy New Year greetings from me then. But anyway, right. The first thing I'd like to say, a few announcements. Well, actually only one. Thank you. Can you do that again next time it happens? Good. Okay. Is that I finally managed to get all the marking done with the help of both secretarial help and assistant help, etc. It's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of work going through 300 answers. Well, not answers, 300 sheets of answers, partly because there was quite a bit of variation in your answers. We will be talking about variation today. Variation in spelling, variation in all sorts of things that I didn't really expect, and I needed to make sure that I come up with some kind of more or less fair way of evaluating this. I mean, if you've got an author who is spelled M-U-G-D-A-N and it ends up as M-A-Y-D-E-N, then I'm wondering why. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, I had to deal with those kind of things. I will upload the Excel sheet with your matricule number and the number of points you got, and I will then also contact a few people who have not submitted or who didn't quite get a sufficient number of points in order for me to be sufficiently happy. And we'll have to organize something there. But don't worry about it at the moment. On the whole, I was quite happy with the results. Okay, so you'll get more information on StudIP there. Good. I will also, at some stage in the lecture, remind you that you have to register for the exam, for the Modulprüfung. It's a bit unfortunate that you have to do this as a separate stage, because, I mean, if you're attending the lecture course, it sort of would be implied in my way that in my understanding that you're also taking the exam if you're a BA or a BEd student, but the bureaucracy here requires you to sign up for the exam, and I'll give you a bit more information about that later on. If I don't, please remind me, but I should be able to remember that. Good. So much for the organizational aspects, and I'd like to move over to the last lecture on syntax, last lecture on grammar. What did we do in the last few lectures? We looked at some of the basic features that exist for grammatical analysis. You only got the very basics in some ways. There's a lot more out there, but that's obviously just what we can cover in a few lectures. We looked at word classes, we looked at phrases, we looked at clauses, and to some extent we tried to draw some trees in order to show the hierarchical relationship that holds between several, between different parts of sentences. Okay. And I made a big point about that this is a fundamental way of organizing sentences that is, good to know in the sense of, I mean, good to understand. Okay. I also introduced you to things like tense, aspect, mood, voice, etc., as features of the verb phrase. Okay. Today, I would like to... the overarching topic for today largely is variation. Okay. Variation with respect to different text types, different registers, and variation in grammar. Okay. Not variation in pronunciation or variation in lexis or something like that, but variation in grammar and syntax. We will be looking very briefly at some standard versus non-standard use in dialects. I'll have a section on speech and writing as well, and a few other points that I would like to mention. And then I'll finish the lecture with a few comments on what's known as word order. And I can't resist giving you a little bit of advanced syntactic fun. It's not funny. it's just fun. A few examples of where you could go if you're interested in more syntax. Okay, right, that's what I have for today. And next week we'll be doing semantics then. Okay, right, first about variation in different text types. Can you more or less read this? Yeah, okay, is it legible? Okay, good. I introduced you to the different tenses. Remember, English only has two tenses, the past tense and the present tense, and what's commonly called future tense in some textbooks isn't really a tense, but is something that needs to be created in other ways than with morphological rules or morphological means. Okay. So, in present, so far so good, and what you can do is you can look at which text type has a preference for a particular tense, or which tense is more likely to occur in certain text types than in others. Okay. So, for example, the present tense is often found in sentences like this: he goes to London. Okay. This is called the simple present, okay, base form of the verb, except in the third person singular, where we've got an S, the morphological marker of inflection. Okay. But what is the meaning, or what is the use, actually, one could ask? Well, there are two major meanings and one minor. And this kind of thing, I suspect, you will have been exposed to in your English classes at school, and this is the kind of thing that you will also be teaching to your future pupils at some stage in your career. So, major meanings, for example, current state. Well, not for example, major meanings. One of the two meanings is you use the present tense to express a current state. The bus has four wheels. Okay, the simple present. Okay. The other one is habitual action, or some kind of general truth. Okay. I take the bus to work. Okay. I don't have a car. I take the bus to work. Okay. And there is also this minor meaning which refers to some kind of current action. Here comes the bus, okay, which you take to go to work. Okay. The more usual way of rephrasing this, typically, is the bus is coming. Okay. But you can, in the right context, say, here comes the bus. Now, these several meanings, two major meanings and minor meanings, have different preferences, as I said, as to where they occur in what type of text, etc. So, for example, we can say that in conversation and also in academic prose, we find quite a lot of present tense. Okay. Also, you find it in text types like this. And the forehand reply of the first point of the tiebreak, and here comes Henman with a forehand, and Gustafsson goes cross-court, and Henman's in behind his forehand. Henman's there for a volley into the empty court, first point to Henman. Okay. What's this? Sports commentary. Okay. Those kind of texts very often use present tense, and it's sort of understandable why. After all, the action is happening as the commentary goes on. So we have several instances here of present tense or simple present tense verbs. Okay. But, and I already mentioned this when I introduced those different tenses and the different forms of the verb phrase, present tense does not necessarily mean present time. Okay. It can mean future time. It's open day on Wednesday. Universities in Britain have open days where future students can have a look at whether they really like the university, because they have a choice between different universities. They have to apply to be accepted at the university, and it's a big thing in British universities to be attractive to future students, okay, because they bring in money, okay, unlike you. Okay. Okay. I know it's a different system. I'm not saying that... Anyway, let's not get into politics here. Okay. You can also use present tense and refer to the past. Okay. So yesterday afternoon, Pete comes home from fishing. That's a bit odd, isn't it? After all, it is clearly a past event that is referred to. Okay. This kind of thing is called, and you may have heard this, conversational historic present. Okay. I'll come back to this later on in the lecture again. Okay? Or sometimes it's also called the historical present tense. Okay. So in terms of the actual form use, in terms of the morphology involved, we have a present tense form, but we refer to an event in the past for reasons that I will mention, as I said, a little bit later on. Okay. Now, prose fiction, as a different text type, as a different register, or different genre, has a completely different preference for tenses. You will find a lot of past tenses. So, for example, once upon a time, there lived a pretty little girl. When she was young, her mother sadly died. Her father remarried, but the girl's stepmother was a mean woman with two ugly daughters. Okay? Bit of a... Okay, well, anyway, right. Okay, here we see all the past tense verbs. Lived, was, died, remarried, was. And this is very, very typical of these kind of narratives, prose fiction, etc. Okay. Again, this I would say is sort of the standard use. There are a couple of others for past tense as well. So if you say in present tense, there is a meeting this week, but if that is then reported by someone else, then, as you know, there is this rule that you switch the tense to past tense. He said that there was a meeting this week. Okay. Well, these are past events that we've talked about, or it's a description of past events in the story, but you can also use it in certain circumstances, to refer to the present. Did you want a cup of tea? Okay. It's not that you wanted it an hour ago, okay? But the question is, do you want a cup of tea now? Okay. But you can say it in such a way, why is again a different question. We'll move into those kind of questions when we talk about pragmatics as well. Okay. Did you want a cup of tea? It refers to the present situation, but you use a past tense verb. Okay. Right. So this was a bit about verbs, okay. But text types also very sharply differ with their use of noun phrases or nominal elements or nominal groups. And I will give you a few examples there. The first one is this here. And just sort of to recap or to awaken again your knowledge of things like noun phrases and verb phrases, etc. Can you just for a minute or two try to find the noun phrase boundaries here? What are the noun phrases and what form do they have? How long are they? Do they contain pre-modifying elements, etc.? Just for a minute, so maybe you can work together with your neighbor or alone, just so. Okay, there are quite a few here, and I'm sure you will have found most, if not all of them. I've marked them in red here. Okay, so we first got Renzo, the name. This is actually an interesting case here. Renzo and the head director refers to the same entity, right? It's the same person. Some people call this, or many people in grammar call this, an apposition. Okay. And you could sort of question whether it's two different noun phrases or a single one, but let's not worry too much about this here. The newly installed laser light show. Okay. One unit, one noun phrase with a lot of pre-modifying elements. Okay. The main floor, and then some very pacey techno. Okay. Yes, the techno, again, repetition of the noun phrase here. And then Italian dance floors. And you can look inside the noun phrase and say which one is the head, which one is the important word, and which ones are the pre-modifying elements. And you can see what I've got here, the red elements here are the pre-modifying elements, okay, or the determiner. So Italian dance floor, or very pacey techno, we've got elements that modify the head of the noun. Mm-hmm. And we can look at such texts and we can say, well, the majority of noun phrases have pre-modification, for example. Or there isn't a single noun phrase with post-modification. Mm-hmm. Other texts are quite different. Here is one from a legal text. This is actually from the rules of Lancaster University. Okay. They have exams, and they do exams very differently. They do the exams in large halls, and there are very strict rules about who has to sit where. And of course, they also have all sorts of possible offenses that shouldn't happen. But if they happen, then they have to have rules about this. Can you again have a quick look at this, and see whether you find, again, the noun phrases, and maybe think about it before I tell you, in what way the noun phrases are different here, in what way the structure, the internal structure of the noun phrases is different. Again, I'll give you a good minute to do this. Okay. Right, again I've used some color here. You can see that there are rather long stretches that I've indicated as being individual noun phrases. This one's simple, easy, a student. And then we've got an academic offense with a pre-modifying element. Okay. Section A11. The invigilator, so far there isn't anything that is radically different from what we've seen before. But then we've got things like the director of student services, where we have, well, what's the head of that noun phrase? Director. And then it tells us what kind of director. Okay. So we have post-modification. The examination, fine. Him, a noun phrase realized as a pronoun. But then, a written report giving full details of the circumstances of the alleged offense. All of this is one noun phrase. But it contains, well, what kind of report? It contains post-modification in the form of a whole clause. A written report which is giving full details, and what kind of details, of the circumstances, and what kind of circumstances, of the alleged offense. So we have a whole lot of post-modification here in noun phrases. And in fact, well, we have director of students, we have noun phrases within noun phrases, full details of the circumstances of the alleged offense. We have, well, I can go sort of three levels down, okay? All within one noun phrase. Okay? Now, this is a very different text type. Okay? This is legal language. This is legalistic language. Well, this is, it has to be very clear, it has to be very definite. You have to be sure that if a student is found, then you can actually know exactly what to do in the right circumstances, etc. Okay. Now, it seems that post-modification of noun phrases is particularly likelier to occur in such contexts. Okay. And you can look at the internal structure of phrases, and you can more or less guess sometimes, from a purely frequency point of view, what kind of text it is, what kind of genre, what kind of text type. Okay. And all of this only by looking at the grammatical structure of the features that make up the text. Okay. So just to sum this up, the second text contains noun phrases with post-modifying elements. We've got relative clauses and we've got preposition phrases. And sometimes the relative clause contains another preposition phrase, etc., etc. Okay. While the noun phrases of the first text were much simpler and they only contain pre-modifying elements, if any. Okay. Now, it doesn't mean that all the noun phrases have to have very complicated elements. We had a simple noun phrase this as well, the student. Okay. But you will find on the whole, if you look at all of them, you will find a lot more that are more complex. Okay. And, as I said, these differences are typical of the difference between various text types. And I would like to give you an extreme example of this. Okay. The extreme example has to do with sequences of nouns. Okay. Here is a nice example. This is about the Halifax, Britain's biggest building society. Also disclosed that it had set aside a 20 million provision against its loans to the collapsed London Docklands Developer Kentish Property Group. Okay. London Docklands Developer Kentish Property Group. And in fact, it's not only that, but it's also collapsed, which actually belongs to the same noun phrase. So we've got a very, very dense noun phrase. Okay. Here's another one. Carol Hemingway, ardent feminist and a Los Angeles radio talk show host. Okay, Los Angeles, you could say, is one word. But still, graphically, it consists of two items. Here's another one. Light Rapid Transit Project team member Mark Haslam explains. Okay? What kind of language is this? Where would you find this kind of thing? Newspapers. Yes. Why? Newspaper. Yeah. Why? Because newspapers, well, it's a question of space, yeah? Is that what you... Yeah, exactly. They put a lot of information, it's very dense, partly because of space considerations, but also because they want to keep the attention of the readers and say the important bits, for example, in the headline. But these are not actually headlines, so it's actually something that happens in the actual newspaper texts themselves. Here's another one, that's the last one. IRA assassination target Sir Peter Terry. Okay. Is selling the home where he nearly died in a hail of bullets. Okay. You could rephrase this. You could say, Sir Peter Terry, who was an assassination target of the IRA last year. And you would say exactly the same thing, but you would do it in a very different grammatical structure. You would use up more space, and the items would come in sort of more separate chunks, so to speak, from a cognitive point of view. Okay? And it seems that this densification is a very typical feature of newspaper language. I did a quick study, had a quick look in the British National Corpus, something which you could do yourself as well, and I had a look at how often a sequence of six nouns actually occurs in different text types. Okay. So all I did was I looked for six times noun in sequence, and I said within the same sentence. Now, in newspaper language, I found about 50 instances per million words. 52, I think it was. Okay. So, if you've got 1 million words of newspaper data, you are likely to find around 50 of those cases. Okay. 1 million words, I think I've said before, is around 8 medium-sized books. So, it's not extremely frequent, but, I mean, these are also extreme cases, six nouns. Okay. If you now compare this to academic prose, okay, which is also a very formal register, which is also a register where you would expect quite a lot of density of information. Okay? We have radically fewer instances of those sequences. So quite clearly this is something which is very typical of newspaper language. In the fiction section of the BNC, this hardly exists. Okay? Very, very few instances. Okay? And then SCG, this actually stands for spoken context governed part. So this is spoken language. But in the British National Corpus, there are two types of spoken language. One is the kind of use that we have now, where, for example, a lecturer gives a lecture. Or we have business meetings, or we have radio phone-ins. In other words, the content was selected on the basis of the context in which the language was used. And quite a few of those contexts are more formal, and quite a few of them are business meetings as well. And in these kind of contexts, particularly mentioning names of companies, etc., and things like that, this kind of sequence of noun occurrence also is found. Not very frequently, okay, but still about as frequently as in academic prose. If you look in the spoken demographic part, meaning the part where people have spontaneous conversations with family members, with friends on the street, etc., you find a few of those, but they actually turn out to be things like someone singing a song and going something like dum 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 and whatever, and the tagger, the automatic tagger said dum, I don't know dum, must be a noun. Okay? So we've got quite a few of those. In fact, I think there is only one single real instance in several million words which would qualify as such a noun sequence. Okay. So very, very strong preferences and strong dispreferences for these kind of things in different text types, and the same, although with not as strong preferences, can be said about many grammatical constructions. We saw it with post and pre-modification in noun phrases. We can also look at different text types and verb complementation, etc., etc. Okay. Now, of course, you can only do this if you've got knowledge of the structures of English grammar. So, in a way, a study of the text types, if you're interested in genres, etc., in a way presupposes that you know enough about grammar in order to do this. So, in some way, syntax is sort of one of the building blocks for a better understanding of how text types work. Okay, so much for variation across text types. Yes?
What does it mean,
PMW? Oh, yeah, good question. Thank you for asking that. PMW means frequency per million words. Okay? When you want to compare sections of a corpus that are not of the same size. Okay. We have, let's say, 10 million spoken words, 5 million newspapers, it's actually more, it's something like 9, 16 million fiction and verse. If you want to compare frequency of occurrence of a particular phenomenon across these different sizes, you need to normalize. You need to say per million words, or per 10,000 words, or in fact per 27,513 words. It doesn't matter, as long as you normalize per the same number of words. Okay. And this is what I've done here. I calculated per million words. Okay. Right, that's what I wanted to say about text types and variation of grammar across text types and genres. And I would now like to move on to variation across modes, so to speak, or I would like to talk about variation across speech and writing. And here I have to say, I have to apologize for a change in style, because what actually happened is that I merged two lectures or two parts which I have to some extent given before, but then I had a computer crash and then I didn't have enough time to fix the style. And just changing it all over didn't look good either. So I just thought you can handle a bit of clash here, okay? Because you've seen these slides before, okay? This one and the next one. In about half an hour, I'll switch back to the old style. Sorry about that, but I'm sure the content is more important than the style. And a bit of violet or pink. What's this color called in English? Is probably fine. Right, okay. Moving to the difference, again, in the context of grammar, between spoken and written language. Okay. I gave you this before. Can you say that? I gave you this before? Yeah? I gave this you before? You say no, okay. In Lancaster you can. He gave it me. Okay. Can you give it me, please? Okay. It's perfectly acceptable in Lancaster, where I lived for 3 years. So again, this is a kind of variation on the grammatical level. I'll come to that in a minute. Okay. But first I would like to talk about grammatical variation in spoken and written language. Okay. Here we have the written part. The written text that I've shown you before. The description of a rainbow by D.H. Lawrence. Okay. And here we have the description of the rainbow by a speaker, normally after very heavy rain or something like that, and you're driving along the road and far away you see, well, a series of stripes formed like, etc., etc. You can see how this is very different from the description that D.H. Lawrence gives us of a rainbow. Can you, for a minute, please, have a look at this extract in a bit more detail and note down or think about which of those elements that you see here are specifically spoken. Okay. Not necessarily only in terms of grammar, but just anything that you find is particularly spoken in quality. Okay. Things that you wouldn't write down, or that wouldn't occur in this order in written text. Okay. Another minute, please. Okay, what have you got? Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got ers and ahs, and these sort of are filled pauses, as they're sometimes called. Okay. Things that we do. I just did one, sorry. Things that we do. Okay. okay. This always happens. I'm not doing this on purpose. I'll try not to use one for the next 2 minutes. Very difficult. We do this all the time in spoken language because we have to think about what we want to say next. And using filled... I'm pretty good at it, yeah. Using filled pauses seems to help organize what we want to say, and if we don't do it, then pauses occur anyway. So I'll stop talking like that again and produce filled pauses again anyway. So we do this, and they are clearly they're clearly features of spoken language. People actually disagree whether they're words or not. Should they be treated like words? You can take them out and don't really change the message, that's true, in terms of content. But it's not just as easy as that. They have some functions as well in terms of communication between people. Okay? For example, I give the message that I wouldn't like you to take over when I'm talking to you on a face-to-face basis. Okay? Clearly that's something. Anything else that's clearly spoken language? E? Mm-hmm.
Well.
Okay. Which is somewhere... Oh, yes. Third line. Well, okay. Yes, some kind of marker of... What does it do? It's sort of some indication. Notice how I said it's sort of an indication. This sort of is about the same thing, right? It's some kind of hedge, some kind of. I don't want to say it is a hedge, but some kind of hedge. Well, so the speaker isn't quite clear what he wants to say or whether that's the accurate word to say it and introduces this well. Okay, is that what you wanted to say as well, or...? You see what I mean, okay? I've got these things. If you see what I mean, okay? Yeah?
Something like that.
And something like that. Exactly, yeah. Now, some of these are more integrated into the grammar in the sense that, well, these are... You could write it down, okay? But it doesn't really happen in written language. Okay. These are well-formed sentences in a sense, or sentence fragments. Okay. Whereas others, like and also things like well, seem to be very, very discoursey. Okay. Discourse markers is something that I think you mentioned. Okay. Then there are other things which may not have been immediately apparent to you. Things like which they seem to be separate. Mm-hmm. Now, either this is a false start... Or, well, in any case, the subject sort of is repeated. Okay? It should be which seem to be separate, or they seem to be separate, but not which they seem to be separate. Yeah?
What about very, very far away? Seems to be
spoken. Yes, the repetition of very... in written language, we would express very, very differently. We would say exceedingly far away or extremely far away or something like that. But spoken language tends to be more iconic. We just sort of... It's easier to say very, very. It's also something that I don't have to think about much. Right? Okay? Okay. Right. Now, some of these elements are clearly elements of grammar. That's why I would like to look at grammar and speech a little bit more with you. And some of the other elements are more outside traditional syntax or traditional grammar and are more, well, what we're going to talk about when we do discourse analysis later on in a few weeks' time. Okay. Right. That was the introduction to this, and now let's look at some of those features in a bit more detail. Here's another one. Old man MacArthur, he was a wee chap. Oh, very small and beard, and he was pretty stooped. Okay. This is a description of a man, old man MacArthur. Notice again we've got old man MacArthur, he. Okay. In written language, we would say old man MacArthur was a small chap or wee chap. Okay. Or we would say something like this when we want to refer to a man. A man who turned into a human torch 10 days ago after snoozing in his locked car while smoking his pipe has died in hospital. Okay. What do we have in terms of noun phrase structure? We've got one large noun phrase. All of this could be replaced with he. He died in hospital. Again, we have a lot of post and pre-modification, etc. In spoken language, we don't do this. We don't do this because spoken language is produced online, is produced on the go. I can't sit down and write the sentence and correct things, but I need to produce it as well. Online is, I guess, the best way of phrasing it. So, what happens actually is that spoken language tends to come in chunks. One piece of information, old man MacArthur. Next piece, he was small. Next piece of information, in fact, very small. Okay? And he had a beard. And he was very stooped. Okay? So we get these in single chunks, so to speak, whereas a written text would use a much more complicated or more complex pre-modifying and post-modifying structure in the noun phrase. Okay. Now, speech and writing varies on various levels, of course. One is lexis. We heard very, very, and versus exceedingly, so this is a question of choice of lexis. Not only, but also. Okay. Density. Okay. I mentioned density in the context of newspapers. Clearly, there are other aspects of density as well, and spoken texts tend to be much less dense in information, how tightly information is packaged. And then they can differ in terms of syntax, and that's what I would like to look at in a little bit more detail, but not only. Okay. As I've said before, it's because we produce things online, and written language isn't subject to those kind of time constraints. Okay. One person who's done work on the difference between spoken and written language is Jeffrey Leach at Lancaster University. And he comes up with basically three possible scenarios. The first one, and some people believe this is true, although they're not linguists, spoken English has no grammar at all. It is grammatically inchoate, chaotic. Okay? That's one option. The second option is spoken language, spoken English does have a special grammar. It not only does it have a grammar, but it does have a special grammar. Okay? Its grammar is just... No, sorry. I should be reading what's on the slides here. It does not have a special grammar. It is just the same as written English. And of course, the third one, that's the one which I thought was second. Spoken English does have a special grammar. It has its own principles, rules, and categories which are different from those of the written language. Now, which of those three are true? Which of those three is the best way of looking at things? Well, the first one, you could think if you look at something like this. No, do you know where the where the fire station is not the one that white? What's this? Okay. It probably wasn't not the one that white, but intonation is missing here. But what we have here is something which probably made sense in context. Maybe someone's looking at a map. I'm not quite sure what's happening. Maybe someone's pointing in the right direction or whatever. Okay. If we look at this from the rules, well, on the basis of the rules of grammar that we looked at so far, then this is chaotic. This is not complete. Things are broken off, etc., etc. This would suggest that spoken grammar can at least just be virtually non-existent. Okay. However, we also find things like this. This is about a man, and I think he was looking for his dog. The trouble is, if you're the only one in the house, he follows you, and you're looking for him, and every time you're moving around, he's moving around behind you, so you can't find him. I thought, I wonder where the hell he's gone. Where the hell's he gone? Has he gone? Okay, and laughter again. I mean, he was immediately behind me. Okay. That's perfectly okay in terms of the rules of grammar. There is hardly anything here which gives it away as something that couldn't also be written down. Okay. So, quite clearly, the first of the three options doesn't apply because you can't say that spoken language doesn't have grammar. Okay. So, let's have a look at the other two options. Well, one of the things that you can do is you can say which is more likely to occur, which forms are more likely to occur. But that's something different from saying has a special grammar or not. So, for example, if you compare those two sentences or those two utterances, which one is more likely to be a spoken text? Yeah, it's a big house, 6 bedrooms. Or living in a big, dirty communal house, eating rubbish, makes you put on weight and etc. Which one is more likely to be spoken? I think you agree the first one. Okay. Again, we've got individual chunks of information. It's a big house, information one. 6 bedrooms, information two. While the second one, again, has a much more complex structure of ordering elements. Okay. But the point is both are possible in speech, but A is much more likely. So in a way you could look at it from a probabilistic point of view. which would say, which suggests that we have the same grammar, it's just with different weightings depending on whether it's spoken or written language. So, in the same way as we have different probabilities in different registers, written registers, let's say newspaper or fiction, we have different probabilities of occurrence in speech versus writing. This kind of thing, of course, can be very nicely investigated with the use of corpora, and in particular, spoken versus written corpora. But there is more than that, and that's what I would like to focus on for the next few minutes. Have a look at this one. This is on the phone, right? Oh, hello. My husband and I are wanting to go to the Hook of Holland next week. To go to the Hook of Holland, yeah. Okay. Anything noticeable here? Anything that you would perhaps not write down? Mm-hmm. Oh, hello. Okay. Good. Yes. That, yeah. All right. Okay. Good point. True. Yeah. But I'm actually looking at something else, something more grammatical, so to speak. Yeah? Okay. You make another important point that I hadn't thought of. There are different levels of formality involved in here and prescriptive rules about whether it should be my husband and I or me and my husband. Okay. That's again not really what I wanted. Yeah? Are wanting to go. What's odd about this? Mm-hmm. Sorry? It's informal. It's not just informal. What kind of verb is want? We have a progressive here. Remember, I introduced you to the progressive aspect. But it's something which is not usually used in the progressive. Okay, I mentioned, I think, that the progressive is becoming more frequent nowadays in English. When you go to McDonald's, then you're loving it. Okay, but what does this actually express here? Is it just formality? Well, I'll give you another example. This is, in a way, already looking ahead to when we do pragmatics. Here's a second one. These are speakers in business meeting. So all of that, you see, when you develop, devolve power, as they did with the divisional structures, just all went off and did their own thing. And unfortunately, we're having to sort of come back from that and say, well, is that the most cost-effective because we've got to cut our costs? Anything here which is particularly speech-like or spoken? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. We're having to sort of come back. We have this hedge, sort of. Okay. It's not just we're having to come back. Well, sort of come back. What does it mean to sort of come back? You either come back or you don't come back, right? And again, we've got the progressive. Yeah. We again have a verb in the progressive where we could also say, we could also have found, we have to come back. Why? Well, people have looked at many examples of this, particularly in spoken corpora, and they found that this kind of thing happens to sort of lower the blow of the message in terms of, being polite, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's some kind of effect of, it reduces the blow. Okay. It reduces the face-threatening act. Okay, I'll be talking about things like that when we do pragmatics again. Okay, but the interesting thing is, this happens in the form of a grammatical form. The use of a progressive, when really the rules of written grammar would suggest that no progressive should be used. Okay. Something else. Okay, this is about buying a magnum in a small village, okay, or in a provincial town. So we're looking in there and we can't find any magnums, so we turn around and he actually interrupts his phone call to say, you know what you're looking for, and we have... No, to say, you know what you're looking for. And we said, have you got any magnums? And he sort of shook his head in a way as to say, no, you know, we don't get such things. It was a complete rejection. Yeah, and we sort of took a step back from the thing then there, and it was labeled Magnum. Okay. This is perhaps a little bit more difficult to find just from looking at the text, but have a look at the verb forms here. We're looking in there, and we can't find any Magnums. So we turn round, and he actually interrupts his phone call. What's this? Present tense. But it's in the past. And then, as part of the narration, the speaker switches. Okay. And he sort of shook his head, and we said, etc. Okay. So it's this use of the historic present for some aspects of it, and then when something changes in the situation, there is a sudden switch, which is really odd in a way, because why should the tense switch? I'll give you another example here. So we were in this car, it was just in its lot, and all of a sudden the buzzer sounds. Okay, sounds absolutely okay, but if you look at it from a strictly formal point of view, something happened, and then something happens. This is not really logical in a way, okay? But it makes full sense because we have a setting, and we have then something that happens. And it seems that in spoken language, you can support this kind of thing with changes in tense. Okay? The use of the historic present tense. Okay? Another example here. When I went to see it, the guy says to me. Okay? Strictly speaking, wrong, but apparently a feature of spoken grammar. It's a rhetorical device for narration. People who have looked at this are two people from Nottingham, McCarthy and Carter, and they write, such variation is by no means random or unmotivated, but coincides with important segments of the narrative where listeners are, as it were, taken in and out of the story world in real time, as though they are participating in the drama themselves. Mm-hmm. And they have, they talk about a spoken grammar. Yes, is there a question first?
This can be called prolepsis or emolepsis, speech of tense. With the language, in literature, there are
I'm not a literature person, possibly. I know very little about literary criticism. Anyone else help here? Prolapse and?
Prolapse, emolepsis,
and your term. Shall we move on? Yeah, okay, yeah. Yes?
I don't think you can actually use those terms here because you're not actually referring to the future or the past, and then what the analyze the lens are about.
Okay. All right. Okay. Sorry, I only know something about English grammar. No. Maybe I should know, but anyway, yeah. Okay. Right. The point to be made here about spoken grammar. So these people actually believe there is a special grammar of spoken language. The point to be made here about spoken grammar is that a wide range of strategies is available to speakers to create and reinforce relationships. After all, when we speak to each other, we reinforce relationships. We don't just speak to each other to convey information, but we have a sort of relationship when we talk to each other. Not a very close relationship necessarily, but there is a relationship. Okay. To involve or detach their listeners, and that the verb phrase morphology plays a key role in signaling these functions. Okay. There are a few more of those, and I need to hurry up a little bit, so I'd just like to mention a few of those. Spanish is more widely used, isn't it, outside of Europe? It's a bit odd. You know which one I mean, probably. It's a bit panicky, but I've not got any deadlines like you have, though. Okay. All of these have elements in them which are in a position where we wouldn't find them in written language. Okay. And this happens because of real-time constraints when I'm producing language online. Okay. This is unrehearsed speech. Okay. Also, it's a nice way of saying what is the topic. Again, we, strictly speaking, create ungrammatical sentences. on the basis of the rules of written grammar, but it seems to be something which is very common in spoken grammar. Okay. Okay, a few here. Paul, in this job that he's got now, when he goes into the office, what's odd here? Paul, when he goes into the office, he's never quite sure. We repeat the subject. We do this again because I said in spoken language we have these chunks which are presented as individual chunks. His cousin in Beccles, her boyfriend, his parents bought him a Ford. Okay. Sounds very odd when I read it to you. But I'm sure when that person spoke, it sounded perfectly natural, again, because individual chunks are presented one by one. Okay. And he's quite a comic, the fellow, you know. That's odd. Why not just say, and the fellow is quite a comic, you know? Or talking about shingles, illness. It can leave you feeling very weak. It can, though, apparently, shingles, can't it? Okay. Why not just say shingles can keep you very weak? So, in other words, the actual noun phrase content is left until the end. Why does this happen? Why don't the people just, aren't the speakers just say, shingles can keep you very, can leave you feeling very weak? Well, it seems that these kind of right dislocated elements, we will talk about this kind of thing when we talk about text linguistics in 2 weeks' time, have a strong evaluative function. Okay? This can leave you quite weak, shingles, can't it? So it's sort of as if an evaluation happens. Okay. And usually occur in contexts where speakers are expressing judgments, opinion, stance, etc. So again, this is about interpersonal relationships and how they are expressed in conversation. Can you lower the level of internal conversations a little bit? It would be. Thank you. Right. Not saying something also means something. Okay. We also find very clear errors. X's had to be delayed because his teeth were slow coming down, which, fair enough, that was just one of the things, it was unavoidable. What do we have here? Which, fair enough, that was just one of the things. That's wrong, isn't it? It's a reduplication of the subject. It should fit there, because it's not that big, I don't think. What do we have here? We have some kind of double negative. Okay. But this is a different type of double negative from I don't know nothing, which we will come to in a minute. Not actually the double negative, but this would be a non-standard use of negation. But what we have here is some kind of spoken double negative in a much more, well, in a different context. Okay? And it's not wrong or not non-standard on the same level. Okay? Not that big, I don't think. Okay. Here's another quote for you. The important criterion here for a spoken grammar is that irregularities and anomalies that may go against the grammarian's instinct concerning correctness or acceptability should first be checked as to their distribution across speakers and contexts. And where a sufficient number of examples from different speakers in different contexts suggest that a feature is normal and widespread, then it should be entered into the grammar or in the grammar, even though it may still be deemed unacceptable in more formal contexts or in writing. So in other words, this could even be something that could become part of teaching material, because after all you want your students and your pupils to learn how language is used in the real, okay, in the real world out there. And quite clearly spoken language seems to differ a lot from written language with some respects. Now, I'm not saying that everything that happens in spoken language, every false start and everything which is ungrammatical is actually fine. There are these production errors that happen all the time. But here we are talking about elements that occur again and again and again in this apparently ungrammatical form, so they seem to have a particular function in spoken grammar. So why not add them to the inventory of grammatical features? That's basically what people who go to this extreme say. So, to sum this up, this part, spoken and written language differ in considerable ways, and there are various reasons for this. Some of them are reasons of cognitive ability of the speaker, or of the speaker's brain, okay? And some others have to do with the actual interaction between people and the way relationship making of whatever sort is realized. The status of a spoken grammar is debated, but I hope that I've given you a number of cases for a spoken grammar. Okay. Some of the differences that you can observe between the two modes are probabilistic, in the sense that they're not 100% this or 100% that. Okay. So they're not categorical. And a spoken grammar, if we accept that it exists, requires some rethinking about some of the basic units of language, most importantly the sentence. This is an element which I haven't actually spoken much about. I've always talked about chunks which are presented, and these chunks are not necessarily boundaries that conform to sentence boundaries. And then, as I've said before, differences and anomalies are likely to be motivated by the purposes of spoken language in use, and we can use corpora to detect those kind of things quite nicely. Okay? Change in style again. We're back to the third element I would like to mention in terms of variation. I'd like to mention a few words, or talk a few minutes about variation in social dialects. Okay? Standard versus non-standard use of language. What we've done so far is we've looked at the standard picture, okay, the standard English grammar picture. Okay. But dialectal systems can vary to a great extent. You find things like this: father were very tired when he got home. Okay. There are many dialects in England, in Britain, and across the world, around the world, where we use were instead of was. It's the was-were variation. Okay. This is wrong according to prescriptive grammarians in the standard English context, but perfectly acceptable in dialectal uses. Okay. I was sitting down outside the building when he arrived. Perfectly normal standard English sentence. We have a past progressive aspect. Okay. It's a past tense form of be and a present participle. Okay, was sitting. There is a dialectal variant of this. Do you know it by any chance? Very common in Lancaster, but many other areas. Not I was sitting, but I was sat outside the building when he arrived. Okay. A lot of people in fairly informal contexts will use this. But it's a case of a social dialect. It's non-standard usage. Mm-hmm. So we have a past tense form of be and a past participle, which is often in ED. Okay. Here we have a different form, but that's because of the verb sit. So. Okay. This is usually used for the perfective aspect in English, but not for this. Okay. So variation of various forms with respect to social status, social class, social dialect. Okay. I introduced relative clauses before. So, for example, things like the man who is sitting on the chair is my father. Okay. And I introduced the distinction between restrictive and non-restrictive. I'm now beginning to look into this corner there where we have... Can you either move out or listen to me, please? Sorry, I know you don't like it when you're being told off like that, but it sort of bothers me a little bit. Okay. Notice that I said it sort of bothers me. I tried to reduce the blow to you. Okay, it didn't say it bothers me. I just said it sort of bothers me. Okay. A relative clause which is restrictive. Okay. There is another way to form a restrictive relative clause. This is the man I love. These kind of relative clauses happen very often in spoken language, particularly the ones with the relative pronoun being left out. This is the man who I love. This is the man that I love. It's much more common to say, this is the man I love. So again, you could look at this difference between spoken and written there. Now, where is exactly the relative clause in the sentence? Well, we have this is the man, and then the relativizer, which is not there, and then I love. So far, so good. It's possible to leave out the relative pronoun. Okay. And as I said, it's very frequent in spoken language. Let's have a look at another one. This is the man I love. And then, so it's only your grandfather lives there. Does this sound fine to you? I think you're the native speaker, right? So it's only your grandfather lives there? You sort of wonder a bit. It's not okay.
It sounds funny.
It sounds funny. Okay. Why? Can you correct it? That's one way. Who lives there? Okay. So in other words, you don't like the fact that the relative pronoun is omitted. Yeah? Okay. Now, you have absolutely no problem, I think, with saying this is the man I love. Yeah. So, why are you happy omitting the relative pronoun in the first case, but not in the second? You have to say, so it's only your grandfather who lives there. This, by the way, is an actual sentence that was produced in my... Well, this was an Australian speaker of English who asked me about... Well, where my grandfather lives in the house, etc. And then he said, so it's only your grandfather lives there. Okay. And you find this quite often. Okay. Why is it not really possible according to prescriptive rules? Well, let's have a look at this is the man I love again. Okay. What kind of verb is love? It's a transitive verb. It requires one object. Okay. The subject is I. Now, who is the object in this is the man I love? In the man I love? Love, I love the man, okay? So in other words, this is the man who I love the man, sort of, yeah, right? It's just that we don't repeat the man here. In other words, this who repeats or refers to the object of loving. Yeah, can you follow me? So this is the man, I love the man. Okay. Let's have a look at this one. So it's only your grandfather lives there. What's the subject of live? The grandfather. Your grandfather. So, in other words, in the relative clause, the grandfather is not the object, but it's the subject. And the relative pronoun, therefore, doesn't replace the object, but it replaces the subject. Okay. And this is not possible, according to the rules of grammar. Okay. You can only delete it if we have an object relative clause. I didn't introduce this distinction, but now I can introduce it because it is a feature of non-standard English, some people claim, or of informal spoken language, to do it anyway. Okay, when it is a subject relative clause. Okay. A colleague of mine is working on a PhD on this, and he's found quite a few also in the British National Corpus, hundreds of them. Well, maybe not quite hundreds, but quite a few. Okay. This is one way of variation, allowing this in spoken language, in a social dialect, even though it isn't in standard English. There are more extreme cases. This is the woman witch taught us. Clearly not okay in standard English, perfectly okay in some dialects. This is the woman ass taught us. I probably shouldn't pronounce it with a standard English accent as well, but this is the woman at taught us. This is the woman what taught us. Okay. All perfectly okay in a dialectal context. Okay. So some rather drastic changes in the grammar of English can occur when we're looking at what's typically referred to as non-standard English. And in the second term, you will again look at things like that when you look at social linguistics and variation. So this was variation with respect to social class, so to speak, or social dialect. We had speech versus writing. What else did we have? Text types. Okay. Now I'd like to do the last bit, which is regional dialects. And I'd like to do this very quickly with a few comments on the distinction between British and American English. You will hear much more about this two sessions next term, when you do the second part of this lecture course, where you will be looking at lexis and pronunciation and also a bit of grammar together with Dr. Schaefer. Okay. Just a few examples of grammatical items or grammatical features where British and American standard English differ. Okay. And you, I guess, are a speaker of American English? Okay, so you can maybe confirm this because I know more about British English. In American English, you would say, or you would more likely say, my son is at the university rather than at university. She nods. Okay. Fred is in the hospital rather than Fred is in hospital. Nods again. Okay. Good. So, clearly the use of articles is different. Then there is something which people call concord or agreement. Again, many of these examples that I'm giving you are not categorical. They are not 100%. In American English, you are more likely to say Mexico wins against New Zealand, while you are more likely to find Mexico win against New Zealand in British English than in American English. One looks at Mexico as sort of a group of people, and the other one looks at Mexico as an entity which is sort of indivisible, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Different concepts. Okay. I didn't get any nodding there, but... Okay, good. Verb complementation. Do you want to help me set the table? American English. Or would you lay the table? No, lay table in British... Set the table. You set the table, yeah, okay. In British English, you would probably lay the table, but I'm not entirely sure about... Do we have a speaker of British English here? No, okay, good. Do you want to... But in any case, if you use help, you can more likely find help me to set the table in British English. Okay. This has got to do with what form is required inside the verb phrase. Or in American English, but also increasingly in British English, perhaps as an example, as a result of American English influence, is the use of adverbs without ly, which strictly speaking is a case of morphology, but that's part of grammar as well. This is real good. Okay, he sure wouldn't do that. Okay, while British English speakers would say really good, and he surely wouldn't do that. Then there are differences in the area of prepositions. I haven't seen him in years, American English. I haven't seen him for years. I'm in fact not entirely sure about this anymore, whether that's still true, but that's what I found in a textbook on British versus American English, which was published about 10 years ago. Okay. But clearly in years is American English, right? Okay. More on prepositions. Students protest the war, or actually, as the American would say, protest the war, right? Okay, so that's spelling, that's pronunciation differences. But in British English, you would say protest against the war. Okay. So, again, this is in a way, well, it's a question of grammar, okay, which prepositions you can use. Okay. under the circumstances, I cannot stay. In the circumstances, I cannot stay. Okay. And you go, all right, okay. And there are many, many more. So when people talk about the differences between British and American English, they very often talk about lexical items being different, the lorry, truck thing, and those kind of things. Okay. And they talk about pronunciation, things like protest versus protest, and all sorts of other ways in which American and British English differs on those levels. However, few people actually talk about grammatical differences. Most people think that British versus American English doesn't really have all that much to do with grammar. But there are quite a few, and there are more. For example, and I think I may have mentioned this in this context before, the mandative subjunctive. I don't know whether you mentioned this before. This is the thing like, I suggest that this be added to the list. In American English nowadays, you are more likely to find a suggest this be added to the list rather than this should be added to this list, to the list. So there are quite a few of those distinctions in grammar as well. It's just that they're more difficult to notice for speakers on a general basis. Okay, that ends my, not the lecture, that ends my comments on variation, and I'd like to have a few, or I'd like to spend a few minutes on word order. Okay, I'll give you a few examples about what I mean. Sebastian likes syntax trees. Okay. I gave her a book. The girl stumbled, and winter is a wonderful season. Okay. When we talk about word order, we can now look at not actually the order of individual words, but the order of phrases, or the order of elements that are necessary to make the sentence complete. Like is the kind of verb that requires two actors, a subject and an object. So Sebastian and syntax trees. So we have subject, verb, object. I gave her a book. We have a ditransitive verb. We have two objects. So we have actually S-V-O-O. Okay. If we have an intransitive verb, then we only have S-V. And if we have a subject complement, which I'm no longer sure whether I've actually introduced this concept here last year, but this is after verbs like be and seem, etc., then we have subject, verb, subject, complement. Subject, complement, because wonderful season and winter refers to the same thing. So in other words, we have different elements, but what they have in common here is that they all start with SV, and if there is an O, it follows afterwards. This is about word order in English. Okay. English is a so-called SVO language. Okay. Not every sentence has SV and O, as we've seen. There can be some without. And in fact, the subject doesn't always come first. Is winter a wonderful season? A question. Well, in question syntax, obviously things change. We have sort of VS and subject complement. Does Sebastian like syntax trees? Another type of question. Answer is yes, yes. So in modern English, we can no longer ask the question, likes Sebastian syntax trees? This was possible 500 years ago, 800 years ago. There were no syntax trees then, but anyway. But nowadays, we require do support, this question with do. Okay. Again, changing the word order in a way. And there are other reasons for changing word order. Potatoes I like, but chips I can't stand. Okay. It's not I like potatoes, but potatoes I like, chips I can't stand. What we have here is OSV. Okay. As I said, we'll talk more about those kind of things when we talk about text linguistics and information structure. Okay. Why does it happen? Because of contrast that's expressed. Then came the turning point of the match. Okay. You know about inversion. Inversion about adverbs. After adverbs. In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea. Anyone know where that comes from? The Beatles, Yellow Submarine. Okay. In the town where I was born lived a man. There lived, well, a man lived. Okay. So again, we have some kind of inversion which has got to do with the preposition phrase of location. Over the horizon lies a magical kingdom. Okay. It's a lie, exclaimed Andrew. Okay. So we've got inversion after quoted speech, not Andrew exclaimed. Okay. But on the whole, English is an SVO language. Okay. To draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night is fun. Okay. Is that the most natural thing to say? And I'm not talking about content. Okay. Is this the best way to say it? Okay. Well, more likely, you're going to find something like this. It is fun to draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night. Why? Well, because the subject is too heavy. Okay. To draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night is the subject of the sentence. The subject in the form of a two infinitive clause. Okay. This is too long, too heavy, and particularly in spoken language, we don't like those kind of things. But also in written language, you would rather rephrase it, and you would have what's known as it extrapolation, okay, to move the subject to the back. Okay, few aspects there which are perhaps a little bit more advanced than some of the things that I've mentioned before. But as I said, I'll come back to that later. Are all languages SVO? Is German SVO? Well, let's first look at English before we look at German and other languages. This is from an email, bless you. Did our sister research center in Warrensville this morning, about 15 miles outside Cleveland, did the same old talk about why we are here, etc. It seems to get embellished with every iteration. Anything wrong here? Or anything odd? Did our sister research center this morning? What's missing? Who did? The writer, right? I did the same old talk. I gave the same old talk. Okay, so the subject is missing. This is possible in English in informal text types. It's very unusual. Okay. But it is very common in some other languages. You can say, I speak English. Ich spreche English. Je parle anglais. Okay. All with the subject. But parlo inglese. Okay. No subject. Or rather, the subject is in the morphological element. Same thing in Spanish. Говорю по-русски. Same thing. There is no я говорю or whatever. There's no I do. Okay. So it seems that some languages allow a null subject. Okay. These are usually called pro-drop languages, but don't worry about that now. Okay. So those rules are different for different languages. Okay. More on German. Ich lebe in Trier, or the straight translation, I live in Trier. So far, so good. Verb is in the second slot. Vor zwei Jahren lebte ich in Lancaster. Or 2 years ago lived I in Lancaster. Okay. Why lebte ich in Lancaster? Okay. Well, because, and I'm sure you know this, German is a V2 language. In terms of word order, the verb always comes in the second slot. Okay. Unless it's a subordinate clause. Okay. So, I wanted to broaden the horizon a little bit in terms of syntactic elements and tell you that there is a lot more out there in terms of things like word order, etc. Before you pack up, and I've got 4 minutes left, I'd like to bring in the fun, which, as I said, is not funny, but just shows you that there are more interesting things out there. I asked him what to wear. I told him what to wear. What kind of verbs are ask and tell? Well, quite obviously, they are ditransitive verbs. Ask him what to wear. Two things. Told him what to wear. In both cases, we have two objects. In fact, this is a subordinate clause, but don't worry about that. Now, who is the object in the subordinate clause? What? Who is the subject in the subordinate clause? Who wears what? I asked him what. Who is the subject of where? What I should wear, right? I asked him what I should wear. I told him what to wear. I told him what he should wear. But in both cases, the subjects are gone. So it seems to be that it depends on the verb here, what happens in the subordinate clause. It's quite odd. Okay, so it depends. That's the first bit of syntactic fun. I like syntax trees, or you could say I don't like syntax tree. Not, as you know, is used to negate the verb. So far, so good. It doesn't seem that we can get our money back. I don't imagine he'll come. I don't think this is fair. If you rephrase all of these, what does it mean? Does it mean that it doesn't seem? Does it mean that it doesn't imagine? Or that someone doesn't imagine? That is not imagine? Okay. Or not think? Not really, right? It means that I think he won't come. Or I think this isn't fair. Or it seems that we can't get our money back. Okay. So, for some reason, the negative element of the subclause is raised to the higher level. Why? I'm not sure. Okay. Isn't that interesting? All right, for those of you who like syntax. Okay. Now, all I wanted to say is there is a lot more you can do in terms of analyzing syntax. But what I've hoped to give you is the basics in order to go on from there. And basically, if you go on doing English, which I hope all of you will do, then you will, at some stage, perhaps face those kind of questions and analyze those kind of things. I'll just quickly go through this because I've got 40 seconds left. We don't need to do this. You can read this yourself. Next time, there will be something on semantics. And just to get you into the mood, here is Calvin and Hobbes. Safari Owl, that's Calvin, or he thinks that he is, hacks his way through the jungle. Suddenly a giant gorilla rips through the foliage. Clean your room. What? You heard me. It's a jungle in here. Okay. Meaning of jungle? Ha ha ha, yeah, okay. Yeah. A bushel is a unit of weight equal to 4 pecks. Yeah? What's a peck? A quick smooch. A kiss. Right? You know, I don't understand math at all. Okay? Yeah. So, see you next week.